Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our guest this week is the author of the second edition of The Art and Science of Digital Compositing, Ron Brinkman. But before we get to that, it's been a busy couple weeks over here at FX Guide and FXPhD.com. Here at FX Guide, we just started out our Masters of the Craft series. That's conversations with some of the top visual effects supervisors from around the world who are kind enough to sit down and talk to us. We've got people like Kim LeBrary. We've got John Knoll, John Dykstra, Scott Squires, Michael Fink, and more coming out over the next several weeks. Really fantastic interviews and really generous of them to sit down and talk to us. What's quite fascinating about it is the opportunity to sit down with them when they're not actually working on a movie and find out a little bit more about themselves and their background and so forth. Really fun conversations. Now, there's some stuff in those interviews which is going to be exclusive to FXPhD.com and our new term of background fundamentals over there. Mike Seymour is going to be walking through the process of being visual effects supervisor, everything from breaking down a script to the final screening and so forth. And supporting him are going to be conversations with these key VFX supervisors. It's going to be a great, solid foundation of our new term. We've got a ton of fantastic new courses. Head on over to FXPhD.com to check them out. Really great. Actually, one of the courses is a new VFX 101 course, Intro to Compositing, with Ron Brinkman, who will be hosting with Mike Seymour these classes every week over at FXPhD.com. But today what we're talking to him about is just heck of a lot of everything, I guess. Everything from his background over at Sony Pictures Imageworks to formation of Nothing Real and Shake, his times at Apple, what he's doing now, and just really, you know, interesting stuff that he sees in the industry and how he sees the industry developing. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation, so I'm going to go ahead and join that now. It's Mike Seymour and Ron Brinkman.
Thanks for that. And Ron, thank you for joining us.
Oh, great to be here.
Am I right in thinking that, of all places, you're in Seattle at Amazon? Is that correct?
It is true, yes. I'm doing a little work for Amazon. I'm up in sunny, well, not so sunny, Seattle. And, yeah, so, a bit of a change of pace.
So your new book was just that good that Amazon decided to get you on staff? How did that happen?
not quite. It's actually a very convoluted process that got me up here that involved talking to a lot of people, including running into Bezos at a conference and chatting about various things. And yeah, it's a complete left turn for me in terms of it has nothing to do with visual effects or animation or photography or movie making or any of those things. So it's interesting. A new kind of challenge.
Well, before we get to the book, I actually wanted to take you back to before the book. In fact, when you first were at what was the foundation, I guess, of Sony Imageworks, Sony Pictures Imageworks, and you were one of the founding employees of the what is now one of the biggest visual effects companies in the world.
Yeah, no, it was back when I started at Imageworks. It was I think I was about number 5 there, and you know, the name Imageworks didn't even exist at that point. We were a group of people that I had been working at Wavefront, and so obviously I knew all the Wavefront products pretty well. And the Sony thing was just getting started up, and they wanted somebody that was knowledgeable about some of the software, obviously. And so yeah, they offered me the ability, the option to come on board and build this thing. And yeah, I think employee number 5 or so, and then obviously it grew rather rapidly, and we were tossed into the heat of production relatively quickly, and yeah, it exploded after that.
Now, was that at Wavefront at Santa Barbara? Is that?
I was actually based out of Los Angeles, so okay. I was out of the sales office, just going out and, you know, working with customers and everything. So I was already getting my feet into the production world through that route. And but then, of course, diving into Sony, it was nothing but production and long hours and all those good things that were particularly true back then.
Give me a sense of what it was like in those first few months at Sony, because there was a lot of interest because Sony was obviously such a big company, but a real question mark whether or not the industry would move into effects going in-house with the studios. What was it like back then?
Yeah, it was very much an experiment when we first started. You know, the guy that was the people that were sort of interested in starting it up were really pitching the idea. So for the first several months, at least, if not longer, we were just sort of trying to prove we could do things, that we, you know, we were capable of doing stuff that was equivalent to what they were sending out of house. And, you know, I think Sony as a big company saw the sense, at least, of bringing something in-house relative to sending it out. The initial work was all, you know, I think the grand plan was that they were thinking that we'd be diving right into doing, you know, CG dinosaurs and stuff. And my background actually was in 3D a lot more than compositing. But, you know, as a very small startup, it became obvious that you had to get the compositing side of things nailed down first, and you weren't going to start off doing heavy-duty 3D work. So, you know, we quickly, and myself especially, you know, started concentrating on understanding what a compositing pipeline should be and building that out. And so really, you know, the bulk of the first year at Sony, I guess, was, you know, far more 2D than 3D. And I think that benefited Sony because it was sort of, it is the foundation for everything. You can't put out a good shot without having good compositing at the end of it all.
So you mentioned Wavefront. You said you're in sales, but actually before you're in sales, you were doing R&D for them, weren't you?
No, I never did R&D for them. And I wasn't really in sales per se. I mean, I was, you know, working with the customers on the technical side of thing. But I never did any real development for... I mean, my background is in computer science. I have my degree in computer science. But I never did any coding for them other than the kind of stuff that a TD tends to do of, you know, writing macros and plugins and little scripting stuff and that sort of thing.
And that role as a customer ambassador is something that you'd carry through for the next, what, 15 or 20 years, because, you know, you were doing that to a certain extent right through to the Apple period, weren't you?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was in production at ImageWorks, I wasn't doing that. But yeah, once we decided to go off and do Nothing Real and create Shake, then clearly my background of having been in the trenches, as was the background of a lot of other people that started up Nothing Real, it was great because we understood what people wanted. We understood what we wanted. I mean, as much as anything, Shake was really, you know, make the tool that we wish we had. You know, it was nothing about seeing a market opportunity so much as it was just being frustrated with what was out there. And I mean, I guess that is a market opportunity, but it was a lot more focused than you know, trying to get out there and make a lot of money. It was really just, let's just make a tool that solves the problems that we'd encountered every day, and hopefully somebody else will find it useful.
So I visited the Nothing Real office when it was in Santa Monica, and I think it was like on the second or third floor of that office. Tell me, who was involved with Nothing Real at the time of its formation? Who were some of the names that?
I mean, Arnaud Hervas was really the chief architect of Shake. He was the guy that wrote the bulk of the core engine. And I'd worked with Arnaud at ImageWorks, and he was, you know, it was funny because there was sort of, he was on the production side of things as opposed to in the R&D department. So there was all this interesting kind of dynamic back and forth between R&D versus TD. So Arnaud was basically a TD, and consequently it was, you know, very accustomed to writing production-focused code as well. Just, you know, get the job done kind of thing. So I was chief architect. There was a guy named Alan Edwards, who was also, I guess, an animator over at Sony, kind of was the business side of things. Myself, a guy named Louis Cetarelli, who had been a co-CG supervisor with me at Sony. You know, we'd both been CG supervisors there. He ended up taking over a lot of the customer-facing stuff in terms of support and you know, keeping customers happy and understanding what they needed. Peter Warner, who'd been an animator over at Sony, came over, wrote a lot of the documentation, but also did some of the design work. You know, it just kind of kept growing. We got some other people out of Sony and out of other places, and you know, we were up to, I don't know, about 15 or 16 people whenever Apple acquired us.
And give me the lay of the land when you were starting with Nothing Real, because in terms of compositing software, like it was heavily dominated by the Quantels and Discretes at that time, wasn't it?
Well, heavily dominated in the video space, yes. But, you know, for what we'd been doing, there wasn't, you know, even Flame hadn't really penetrated the high-end film market that much. And it was really, you know, it was either, you know, for big facilities, it was in-house code. So Digital Domain already had Nuke. ILM had their, I think it was CompTime is what they had in-house at the time. Rhythm and Hues had an in-house package. But in terms of off-the-shelf software, you know, it was Wavefront Composer was probably the big one. Eddy, if you remember that one. So, you know, the Quantels and the Discretes were initially much more, you know, they weren't as well suited to doing high resolution, lots of layers kind of stuff. You needed to have a batch process, sort of a workflow.
So, Ron, tell me, we'll get to the book in a second, but the thing that's just always fascinated me, did you guys approach Apple or did Apple approach you for that acquisition?
You know, I'm not actually sure because Arno and Alan were sort of the two official owners of the company, and I think it was a matter of, you know, they'd been talking to a lot of people and Apple was looking around, but clearly Apple had been interested in finding something to kind of position themselves in that higher end film market, and I think, you know, we fit nicely into what at the time was their goals. Those seem to change.
And what time did you come out with the first issue of the book?
So the first thing I did was actually teach a course at SIGGRAPH in, 96, I think it was. Whatever year SIGGRAPH was in New Orleans back then.
Yep.
So I taught a basic course on compositing. And, you know, it was really driven by the fact that we'd have a lot of people coming in. I hired a lot of people at ImageWorks to be compositors, and I felt like I was saying the same thing over and over again, you know, just real basic stuff of what's the fundamentals of compositing, both, you know, technically and artistically. So myself and a couple of other guys, Jerome Chen, who's still a supervisor, effects supervisor at Sony still, he's most recently supervised Beowulf, and Gary Jackamuck, who was over at Digital Domain at the time, we put together this basic compositing course and presented that as just a SIGGRAPH course. And that was kind of the genesis of the book, is, you know, getting the real basic stuff down. I think you could probably still find those course notes online. It's, you know, it's just a skeleton of what eventually became the book. But
now the book will come out in 99, so that was, what, 3 years later?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, I did the course. I was still heavy in production, and it wasn't until after I finished up Contact, the Jodie Foster movie with Zemeckis, that I figured, you know, it was time to. I mean, that was a long show, and it was kind of. I kind of was looking for something else to do, and so at the same time as I was doing that, the Nothing Real started. You know, Nothing Real formed. We went ahead and did that, and I started working on the book. So there was that period. I can't even remember now, sort of which which came first, but basically the. The book, I think I was working on the book and then decided to go ahead and leave Sony and do the Shake thing as well. And but they did kind of grow up together. You know, the design of Shake was definitely influenced by what I was putting in the book and kind of vice versa, I think.
Now, you'd go on to work at Apple when Nothing Real sold Shake to Apple. And obviously, you've since left Apple. Before we discuss the second edition, do you have an opinion? Because, I mean, I think I'd be sort of stoned if I didn't ask you this one question. And by that, I mean mobbed. Do you have an opinion on whether it's in the foreseeable likelihood that Apple will move forward with compositing in the way that some people have hoped? Or do you feel that it's really now that they've moved away from that doing anything further in the compositing pipeline of the tradition of Shake?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've been out of Apple long enough that I don't really have a feel for where they are at, so this is purely conjecture at this point. You know, generally, I mean, the reason why I left was it was pretty clear to me, at least at the time, that their interest, you know, when they first acquired Nothing Real, it was, you got to understand, sort of at the time, this was, what, like 2000, 2001, Apple was in a position where they were running on proprietary hardware. There was a big concern that people just didn't feel the effort to port to a Mac was that worthwhile. You know, since then, a couple of things have happened. Number one, they're on Intel. A few things have happened. They're on Intel. Their sales have gone up quite a bit. There's a lot of people that are, you know, clearly porting and running on a Mac. And also the iPod came out, and then, of course, the iPhone. And I think, you know, the concern that Apple had is no longer there, that they have to do as much in-house to keep people, you know, to keep good software on their platform. And just generally, you know, the profit margins on an iPhone are a lot higher than on selling compositing software. So I think their focus is definitely not in the same direction as it was when they first acquired us. And So it became difficult to kind of get the commitment out of Apple to the high end that I wanted. You know, that's my focus, and I was never particularly interested in producing a more consumer facing app. So, you know, we parted on great terms, but it was, at least at the time, I didn't feel like there was enough commitment or enough resources being put towards doing stuff that would satisfy the high end. So I don't, you know, I can't say with any certainty whether there's something being worked on in the bowels of Apple that will come out and blow the industry away. But, you know, I wouldn't put a lot of money on it happening.
So when was it in your leaving Apple that you decided to go for the second edition of the book? I mean, there must have been a fair demand from the community for you to do that, but was that in any way related to leaving Apple in terms of getting free time?
It was, in the sense that, I mean, I had already been working on the second edition. You know, it was already, I guess, 7 or 8 years after the first edition had come out. So it was starting to be due. You know, it was getting to be time to do an update. It was probably past time, but it's a lot of work, so I had to work myself up to it. But yeah, I had started doing some work on that while I was at Apple, and but you know, there was a couple things needing more time to do that was part of my decision to leave Apple. And then the other thing was, like, you know, I mean, with all the stuff I just said, with, you know, not being sure that Apple is really going to be focused in the direction I want. At the same time, the whole Foundry Nuke deal kind of went down, and it was clear that, you know, there was a company that was going to be focusing on that, and so I went to do some work with them as well. So again, it kind of, you know, a few things sort of came together around the same time.
And the new book was initially going to, because I remember talking to you, was going to initially be an update, and it turned into a pretty substantial rewrite, didn't it?
God, yes, it did. I was originally thinking, all right, I can just go ahead and change a couple of the case studies and update a few little things here and there, and that'll be fine. And I don't know, I think it's just something in my nature. I just kept seeing stuff like, well, you know, really, I could do that. And you know, the other big difference with this new edition was that when I did the first edition and I shopped it around, you know, I looked for what publisher was gonna do it. You know, you write up a little proposal and you send it off, and several publishers expressed interest, and I pretty much went with the one that was willing to give me the most color images in the book for that first edition. But that was still back in the day when color imagery was not cheap, and so it was limited. You know, I had a couple or three sections that were sort of the color inserts, but, you know, most of the book was black and white. So with this new edition, color printing has gotten to be economical to do for an entire book, so I knew it was going to be a full color book. And you know, so then as I'm going through it, I started to realize, well, there's a lot of stuff that I just wasn't able to illustrate previously, because it's kind of hard to talk about color with black and white illustrations. So I went ahead and, you know, decided, right, now I can go ahead and show some of the stuff that I only talked about in the past. And so that was a huge a huge undertaking once I really kind of committed myself to doing it. And, you know, I mean, and it was everything from going out and shooting a lot of photos that illustrated stuff. I really beefed up the chapter on learning to see, which was, and it had a lot of opportunity to explain sort of what it, you know, how do your eyes work, and equally important, how does a camera work, because that's really what we're emulating. We're not, when we're doing visual effects, you know, we're not really trying to do what the eye sees, we're trying to do what the camera sees, because it's got to fit in with the rest of the film that was shot through a camera. So yeah, that was a big contributing factor to how much got added to this book. And the other thing was, you know, I wanted to put some new case studies into it, but studios have gotten really bad with not being particularly generous with giving you access to case study materials. A lot of work, you know, it's just a lot of work to try and get something out of them, and they generally want a lot of money too. So I kind of felt like, all right, I've just got to ask for lots and lots of them, knowing that a lot of them will fall off. And when it was all said and done, I actually got quite a few more than I expected. But there was a bunch that I tried to get that did a lot of work on that didn't end up making it into the book, because the studios weren't terribly cooperative. But I ended up with, you know, so right now this new
edition, But there are some very good ones that you have got in there, right? I mean, maybe you missed out a couple of others, but there was some really good stuff in there.
I can't. I mean, you know, you always mourn for the ones that got away, but overall, I got, you know, I got the ones that I really wanted. You know, I got a great. I mean, Lucasfilm was great, because they went ahead and let me take an entire shot and put you know, detailed stuff in there and include the shot on the DVD, so all the pieces that go into making it. So, yeah, no, I mean, it ended up being, you know, like the back, probably quarter of the book is all case studies, looking at the various different things that you can, you know, that you use compositing for. So, which was a lot of fun. But, yeah, it's that initial plan of update a couple case studies and just add a little bit here and there, it just kept ballooning, and I kept coming up with more stuff that I knew I could talk about. And, you know, in retrospect, I probably went a little overboard because it's a pretty big book now.
So I guess I should fess up at this point and say that we are actually doing a course with you at FX PhD. So I haven't had the luxury of really studying your book in immense detail. But I wanted to discuss the section in front of the case studies, as it were, the theory and art in the first section of the book. And I wanted to ask you what, if anything, you sort of saw as an a thread, perhaps, a trend that was dramatically different now than it was when you did the book in 99.
Yeah, I mean, well, the biggest thing I had to go through and sort of touched everything was on the technical side of things, the fact that we're now tend to all work in floating point workflows. And, the first edition of the book kind of looked at everything. I mean, they spent a lot of time talking about 8-bit versus 16-bit and then kind of touched on floating point. And it was clear to me that, you know, the second edition really should just approach the world as if it was primarily floating point and toss out a few bits and pieces about 8-bit or 16-bit work. But, you know, that's ultimately going to be pretty much a historical artifact pretty quickly. So, you know, getting into floating point really also kind of leads you into the bigger, broader sense of high dynamic range, which is really the important part of it. And in the sense that, you know, as we are trying to emulate the real world, understanding that the light in the scene can be a much, much broader dynamic range than what a camera's capable of capturing or what our eyes are capable of capturing. But if you don't simulate things accurately, if you don't acknowledge the fact that there are these massive light variations that are possible, then everything kind of ends up becoming a compromise from that. So that ended up touching a lot of stuff in the book. You know, throughout the book, I had to not only just explain sort of what high dynamic range and floating point was, but also how it impacted a lot of other things that you do. How it, you know, if you do a blur, that if you're not doing that with high dynamic range floating point imagery, it's going to look wrong, and various things along those lines.
Let me talk to you about two aspects, because obviously, we'll take hours and hours to discuss the whole book. I'm just going to pick on two things. One common and one, I guess, more of a hot buzzword, but perhaps a niche thing. Let's start with the niche first, which is stereoscopic. And just give me your take on how much stereoscopic 3D filming and 3D projection is the future of compositing, and how much it's just the emperor has no clothes and this is a passing fad.
I don't think it's a passing fad, personally. I think it's here to stay. I think it's clearly the way we see the world. If we do it right, then why wouldn't you want to have that kind of interactivity with it? I mean, it's just like, you know, when color came along, you know, people can still make black and white movies, and you can still make flat movies. But I think the grammar of film is going to have to change in a lot of areas to acknowledge the way that stereo works. I definitely think it's here. You know, I wish. One of the case studies that I had wanted to get into the book that I didn't get was something that was much more focused 3D, you know, stereoscopic film. And I do regret not having something that's a much more in-depth look at something like that. And you know, not only that, but also just general discussion of stereo in the compositing workflow. So I suspect that, you know, if I'm forced into doing another update to the book, it's going to have to be primarily to rewrite it to reflect the fact that everything's being done in stereo now. But yeah, I don't think it's a fad. I think it's around. I think it's going to, you know, it's going to have some bumpy areas as we try to get it going. And, you know, there are a lot of people that are so accustomed to what stereo was like in the past that they don't understand. You know, I mean, you talk to a lot of people and they'll be like, oh, that gives me a headache. And I mean, that's the thing I hear most often, I would say, when you start talking stereo to people that have, you know, passing experience with it, is that the viewing experience isn't pleasant a lot of the time. But I really kind of think that, you know, those are technical issues. Those are the process not being done properly and introducing artifacts that
for don't... you personally, you're in Seattle, it's Friday night. Are you wanting to go out and see a film stereoscopically, or is this that you think, you know, on paper this is something? I'm just curious. Is it something you personally are really looking forward to seeing Avatar in stereo, or is it that you just think this is a trend that's going to take, that the kids are going to go crazy over?
No, I don't think it's. I'm looking forward to seeing good immersive, you know, grab me by the short hairs and hold me to the chair kind of movie. And I believe that if it's done properly, stereo can add to that experience. But you know, it's like anything. I mean, I don't want to go see stereo for the sake of stereo. I want to go see a good movie done by a good filmmaker that is as engaging as it can possibly be. And so I think the real question is, you know, do I believe that stereo can add to the experience in the theater? And yes, I believe it does.
Well, then,
it's going to be a good movie first and foremost.
Then let's spin around to looking at compositing packages. You obviously had a major role after the Apple thing with the Foundry, but still, can you give me your take on, you know, which packages are looking forward-looking in terms of their stereoscopic toolset? Is the Foundry and Nuke at the front of that, or are there others?
Oh yeah, I mean, and you know, fair disclosure here, I'm still involved with the Foundry. I still you know, work with those guys, and you know, it's not a direct daily sort of thing, but it's sort of an advisory role. You know, keeping an eye on what's going on and talking to some customers for them occasionally and that sort of thing. So it's, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not unbiased here, but I do think that what they are doing, you know, it's interesting because what they're doing in a lot of ways is very, well, there's the two sides of what they're doing. There's the very basic, but I'd say even more important part of it, which is the day-to-day workflow. You know, how do you deal with stereoscopic data in an efficient, non-obtrusive fashion? And you know, what they've done in Nuke, I think, is it's simple. I mean, it's not, you know, there's no major patents that are going to come out of this thing because it's just basically user interface for managing that kind of workflow. But in some ways, I think that's the more important part of it. And then the other thing the Foundry doing was, of course, the Oculus stuff, which is this rocket science, you know, image processing that they're so good at for deriving additional information from stereo data. I don't think the Foundry has a lock on it. I mean, I haven't spent as much time these days, obviously, looking at what's out there competitively. I've seen some of the stuff that, you know, Autodesk is doing, which looks, you know, really interesting as well. I don't think there's a clear leader out there. You know, I would bet on the Foundry in on the side of producing really interesting, you know, plug-in like magic stuff because they're just so good at that kind of thing. And then, you know, I think as a workflow, I think Nuke's workflow is so battle-tested that it's clearly going to be something that's used in a lot of places. But, you know, honestly, I haven't sat down with some of the other competing packages the way I should have and, you know how they compete, where their strengths and weaknesses are.
Okay, well, let's. I said I was going to ask you two things. The second one does actually follow on from the first, which is, let's say for a second that stereo is the future. It's certainly not the majority of work being done now. And that's not to take anything away from it, just, you know, it's a fact, right? So my question to you is, in the area of just keying for a second, just looking at keying and specifically a green screen or blue screen, you know, proper key, is that technology that is no longer sexy and not getting a lot of research? Have we solved it? Are the tools good enough? Or is it that just other big shiny things have got our attention? Because it doesn't seem like there's been much in the way of advances in actual keying stuff now for the last, I don't know, maybe four or five years even.
Yeah, I don't think we solved it. I mean, I don't... And you're right. I don't think there's been anything particularly interesting done in that arena for a while. There's not a whole lot of drive to do a lot more work on that because it's just, you know, if you look at it from a totally mercenary point of view, it's hard to produce a product that is going to get that much notice because it's hard to quantify how much better a keyer would be. So I don't think you see any of the major companies out there focusing a lot of attention on it. And, you know, it is solved in the sense that you can always throw a roto artist at it, right? And solve a lot of the problems.
We have seen some advances in the area of roto. And certainly, I mean, I make no secret about the fact, I actually told the guys at Nuku, great guys at the Foundry, I said point blank, I love the stuff they're doing on Ocular. But, you know, if you want to sell more boxes, make your roto tools really good, because there's got to be, you know, 1,000-to-1 ratio on people doing roto to 3D Ocular type stuff.
Sure. And they know that, and they are working on that. And that's, you know, a lot of the stuff I've actually been doing is sort of helping to spec out some ideas for what roto should turn into and do that. You know, in my mind, roto tools are all about workflow and how do you be efficient with what you're rotoing. And really, I think the biggest thing is acknowledging the fact that keying in general is really not, and I make a big point of this in the book, keying is not this magic box where you press the right buttons and a key comes out. It's very much about, you know, key for the hair, key for the clothing, key for the skin, key for the, you know, a bunch of pieces that kind of get put together. And I think if you really acknowledge that and you build a tool around it, then that's the best you're going to get for keying.
And there also seems to be a trend towards saying, you know what, we're not going to key this, that we're going to on set be more fluid, more natural, and just throw stuff at roto. But at the rate at which people are throwing stuff at roto, I would suggest to you that the R&D department isn't accelerating the ease of doing roto. In other words, there's more roto coming at it than tools to make it easier to do. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I would agree, and I think that's primarily because it's going to take a TD to fix it, not a R&D person, you know. And granted, I'm biased because I was a TD and a supervisor, and I came up through that route. But, you know, like I said, the solution to roto is workflow related more so than technology related, I think. Now, the solution to keying, I do think this whole sense of, you know, blue screen, green screen is going to continue to go away. It's terribly cumbersome. It's expensive. And, you know, that cost of onset versus do it in post is only getting, you know, a bigger and bigger delta as time goes on. I suspect that the big breakthrough in keying is going to be actually with stereo, or more importantly with multiple cameras, you know, something that lets us triangulate on an object, understand its place in the 3D environment, and use that to extract it from a background.
But let's be geeky here for a second. The original keying stuff, especially the shake kind of bias, and I mean, I'm making huge gross generalizations here, was to either roll your own or to use some kind of color difference keying. And that really relies on having a pretty good primary source of a key source. In other words, it's not going to work well on keying off the background of a wall that happens to be a slight shade of mauve. It wants a nice blue screen or a nice green screen, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's sort of the two sides of keying, right? There's the color difference method where you have a strong difference between a couple of different channels, and you're using that to help determine what the background is. And then there's just sort of the general, you know, I'd call it the Primat method, but a really color space method where you define a region in the color cube and use that to determine what it's considered keyed or not keyed. If you talk to the, you know, the real rocket science color guys, they'll tell you that it eventually all does boil down to something inside of a color volume. But
oh yeah, so but the, it's the color, but it's, is, but it's certainly in the second approach, it comes down to more and more elaborate ways with a better and better user interface of defining the shape that is the space that the green screen or blue screen occupies in that three-dimensional cube. In other words, a lot of the tools are about forming a complex shape like a bubble inside the cube that is capturing the shape. Now, that was where we were 5 years ago. I'm not trying to pick on you, but like it is, you know, it doesn't feel like we've had anything beyond that. And yet if we're moving towards getting less actual green screens and blue screens on set, we should... I don't know. Stereo is an interesting option. Obviously, it's a tremendous amount we can learn about the scene and stuff. But if you look at, say, most major Hollywood films, even like a Pirates, they went to great lengths to try and make the motion capture down to one camera. So if it isn't a stereo film, it's fairly unlikely we're going to get reliable second camera data, at least in the short term. I guess I should ask you whether you think in the long term that'll even a non-stereo film would just naturally want to have secondary cameras for visual effects work.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, it's not going to take too many more tools where the benefit of just, you know, cameras are getting so cheap and it's going to be so easy to set up, you know, a couple of very high definition cameras that the effects crew can just set up around the set, get the extra information that you want, and start to use that to extract it. So, you know, if somebody out there is looking for an interesting project, I think that would be, I mean, people are already working on this, but, you know, coming up with some way to take this multiple camera view. I mean, the interesting stuff that's happening is not really in the visual effects world, right? It's the stuff that Microsoft's doing with their, you know, multiple photos that, you know, they pull down and sort of rebuild a pseudo 3D environment of that. You know, that type of thing, I think, is going to make its way into the higher end of filmmaking. But, you know, one thing I would say about the, let me say this before I forget it, is, you know, I don't think the whole blue screen, green screen thing, I don't actually think keying is the problem. It's lighting is the problem. You know, you can make a great key, but the reason why most of those, you know, most stuff that's shot on blue screen and dropped into a scene doesn't work is because the lighting's wrong. You know, you've compromised somehow on how, you know, and maybe compromise isn't the right word, but, you know, you're trying to emulate lighting in a scene by you know, on a set, and it's extremely difficult to do that kind of thing. And so I really think that's the bigger problem to solve, and that's why Roto makes so much more sense, because you can toss somebody into a scene and the lighting is accurate, and then all you have to do is come up with a key, as opposed to, you know, a green screen. And integrating somebody on green screen is two problems. It's creating a mat, but it's also modifying the color of that object so that it fits into the scene properly.
Well, then let's talk about that then, because one of the things I always was hoping was going to happen out of the initial HDR research, and I'm now going back a few years when we first started getting Meyer lighting patterns out of an HDR analysis of a scene, and it would say, you know, we'll put 20 lights in this 3D scene and we're going to get something that emulates the HDR that we sampled with this mirror ball. And I always said, oh, great, that means any second now someone will produce a program that'll give me a real world lighting chart. You know, if I enter, I have these available lights, like Ken flows, it'll tell me where to position them to match the lighting of what I recorded with the ball. Of course, that never happened because, for whatever reason, but it would be great, right? You know, just like
It would be great. I think it's, you know, it's the problem is it can be a very complex lighting setup. And again, you're back to this world of, you know, what's the cost of putting up 20 or 30 lights on a set? You know, when you know, I mean, some, you know, if you've got a really big set and a very expensive lighting package, you may be able to do that, but, you know, is it cost effective?
This is my point, though. I was going to ask you, is it our fault, though? Is it our fault as a group that we've been too flippant in saying, yep, I can do that, we'll fix it in post, we've got a thing, that now filmmakers kind of assume that there's a button under the desk that, if pushed, will solve these problems? Have we oversold how easy it is to pull off this stuff and made a rod for our own backs?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's the same problem that we have with generally fix it in post, right? You know, we've proven that we can. We've you know, pick any number of problems, and we've certainly proven that, you know, just about anything is fixable. So it's just a matter of, you know, at some level it comes back to the economy part of it, where people are underbidding what it takes to get something because they want to get the work. But I don't know. I think too, there's this sort of good enough level that unfortunately a lot of places are willing to put out and have to put out based on their bids, and that good enough level generally is, okay, the lighting is not quite right on this character we just dropped in, but it's good enough, you know. And that's really the stuff I hate to see, because it's, you know, it takes away from the craft, and it produces stuff that's certainly, you know, to an experienced eye, doesn't quite fit into the scene, but people are letting it go because they know that they can get away with it, kind of thing. And that's what I hate to see.
Would it be that an area of research that could possibly aid in this is to look at more complicated tools for relighting? In other words, we shoot an actor and we derive some kind of depth map or some kind of, you know, three-dimensional representation of that actor. It doesn't have to be that accurate. And then we can effectively tweak our key, fill, and whatever lighting. Because yep. If our problem is that, as you said, that's twofold. One, lighting the green screen, but also getting the lighting in the foreground right. We don't have a lot of really good tools other than just sort of color correcting and mats to actually relight someone in the foreground unless we go to sort of very specific high-end things like light stages and you know, specialist shooting environments.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there's you know, one of the case studies in the book is King Kong, and I specifically chose a shot where they did some relighting on a character to fit into a scene. And you know, at this point, it's pretty much build a CG mock-up, light that the way you want to, or you know, do some sort of specialized lighting on it to emulate what the eventual scene was, and then use that to relight, you know, to generate mats to effectively relight the character. And yeah, I think that is there's a lot to be done with that. Some of that, again, if you've got multiple cameras, it's a lot easier to recreate the 3D character that's in the scene, so that you can use that as a stand-in object without having to really go in and model something extremely detailed to match it. You know, you can. I suspect that you'll be able to come up with tools pretty easily. You know, there are already tools that exist that would be pretty easy to come up with a good enough 3D model to you know, work as a stand-in for a character for relighting. So yeah, I think that's an area that will benefit a lot. The other thing that I think that's going to change quite a bit with production relatively soon is lighting in general. You know, you asked the question about, you know, why can't we just get a lighting map for every given scene and then set up the lights to do that? And you know, if you're having to lug around 5Ks and 10Ks and put up a bunch of scrims and toss gels and everything onto something, then yeah, that's a big task. But you know, you look at a world not too far off where you can put up these giant light panels of LEDs and pretty much have a stage where all you have to do is dial in some, you know, some numbers on a control panel and emulate just about any lighting setup you want. That's really going to change things quite a bit. And that's where you'll be able to just kind of feed a environment map into a system, and then it will, you know, set the lights automatically to be proper for what that scene is.
Yeah, which is, you know, the light stage, and it's you know, format of somebody being in a stage and the HDR just literally turns off and on LEDs to get there. So let me ask you a completely different question there, which is just to finish up, which is, it is the art and science of digital compositing. So you are specifically talking about compositing. Yet a lot of things we've been talking about today have touched on 3D. Tell me, how do you see the compositor in terms of the prestige or lack of, the respect or lack of in the, you know, in the light of the sort of 2008 version of the book versus in back in 99, has the compositor, you know, changed their status in the production? Is that any different? Is it more a team sport now? How do you see the actual individual role?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough question. I don't know about, you know, the prestige side of things or not. It's hard to judge, you know, make a generalization about a particular position, because, you know, if you're really good at what you do, then you know, you're always going to have the prestige level. And I think, yeah, you know, just about everybody understands that, you know, that last stage of the process can be the one where it's, you know, it makes or breaks it. I think the more interesting thing is sort of where is that line between 2D and 3D, you know, happening. I you know, I give a lot of talks on this kind of stuff, and everybody always asks, you know, what's the future of compositing? And I'll put up these slides that, you know, basically the future of the future of 2D is 3D, and then the next slide is, and the future of 3D is 2D. And I think there's a lot of overlap that's happening in there. There's, you know, when you're doing 3D rendering, you're starting to, you know, render out in multiple passes. When you're doing compositing, you're starting to have real 3D cameras set up. So I think that line is blurring quite a bit. I think the skill set, though, and this is why you're seeing this a lot, the skill set for compositing and the skill set for lighting, disregarding the technical side of things, but the art side of things is pretty much the same skill set, right? It's somebody having the eye that's able to say this object fits into the scene because it is, you know, the lighting is appropriate for that scene. And that's something that a compositor has to know how to do, and it's something that a lighter has to know how to do. So you're starting to see a lot of people that cross over between those two disciplines. And I think that's where you want, you know, that's the sweet spot. That's the person that can make the final difference in the shot for ensuring that it's really sitting in there and it doesn't feel like it's out of place. So I think that's the interesting part of it.
And for you personally, is it the golden age of compositing past, or do you still find it sexy and it actually, you know, really appeals to you? Is it in your blood? Tell me how you know, for Ron Brinkman, what is it like?
Yeah, I still find it fascinating because it's an incredible, it's still an incredible problem to solve, right? And that's always kind of grabs me, is, you know, there's still so many things that aren't as easy as they could be. There's so many things that, you know, I could see these tools that could be built. It's just a matter of, you know, getting the time and resources to do it. So yeah, I never came into compositing because it was necessary. You know, my background was in 3D prior to diving into production, and so I kind of learned to understand why compositing was there. But for me, the thing that kept me there and interested in compositing more than 3D in a lot of ways was because it was where things get finished. You know, that's what I keep coming back to, is, you know, you put the final touches on something. You know, somebody else can go off and do the rough sketch, if you will. But I always wanted to be the guy that touched the pixels last, you know, and which also sort of raises the extra thing that we haven't talked about, which is, where does the whole DI part of this come in, and the colorist at the very end of it all, and you know, is that going to be, is that really where compositing is going to be? It could be, you know, it could very well be that at some point the final discipline that emerges out of all this is the guy that's sitting on the colorist's box, who has all of the 3D elements and all the lighting passes, and is putting stuff together, but is also doing the final DI, you know, color grade across the entire film. It may very well be that that's the person that does the final touching of the pixels before it shows up on the big screen.
I guess there's one other thing that I thought you were going to say when you said we haven't touched on it, because it's, we're doing obviously another course at FX PhD this term, which is with the sort of supervisors. It's the senior supervisors from all the major houses, and it's an amazing group of people. But in talking to those people, one thing that came across when I discussed what it was that they thought people should do, the number one area that the skill that they should in sort of deliberately go and try and enhance. The answer they all gave, practically, I think with only one exception, was increased photography skills. The skill of, and I touch on this now because, of course, you're also known for your photography work. And I'm wondering, I assume you'd agree with that sentiment, that for a good compositor, photography is key?
If you page through the book, there's tremendous new stuff, you know, tremendous amount of new stuff on, you know, how do cameras work, what's the point of, you know, photography in general, how does it fit into the process? The problem with photography on a big film, the problem with talking about it is that it's a different department a lot of times, and it's also generally not, you know, the first thing that somebody, you know, you generally don't get to walk into a facility new to the industry and be able to touch a camera, you know. But understanding how all that works, because that's basically what you're doing, yeah, absolutely is critical. I guess maybe the reason why I haven't mentioned it is it's just sort of almost assumed that anybody that wants to get into this business should understand what a camera does, because it's just, you know, everything we're doing is coming out of a camera. So if you don't understand that, then you're lost from that point on.
I mean, it's fair to say if someone was – it's probably not the case that many, you know, beginners are listening to this podcast, but if they were – I think it's probably, would you agree that photography and then Photoshop, both accessible and both vital to the grounding of building up your compositing skills?
I think or something, it doesn't have to be Photoshop. I mean, Photoshop has, in my mind, still kind of a weird workflow. It still kind of insulates you from what's really happening there. It's absolutely good to understand and learn Photoshop, but the problem I see is people that only know Photoshop and don't really, you know, they understand how to, and this is really true, I guess, generally, people that only know a package, they don't understand why they're doing stuff a lot of the times. It's, you know, they've seen a recipe for it. You know, if you want to get this look, then go through these 8 steps, you know, or even worse, grab this, collection of stuff that's already out there. So Photoshop is great in that it lets you understand things that can be done. But if all you know is Photoshop, you're generally missing out on sort of what's really happening behind the scenes. I think you need to broaden that up a little bit more. I mean, it's the thing I like. Obviously, I'm biased, but the thing I always liked about Shake was that, and the thing I think a lot of people liked about it was that it's very, transparent for what is really going on. You know, it's down to the metal, and there's all these little nodes floating around, and everyone is just doing its one little thing. But, you know, if you grow up using that kind of an interface, then you understand what's going on. And even if later on you decide to use something that wraps a lot of stuff up into, you know, hides a bunch of the crap you don't need to worry about, that's fine. But being able to understand what's really going on behind the scenes allows you to be so much better at problem solving and figuring out, you know, how do I make something work? And also, what's this artifact I'm seeing? Where is it likely to be coming from? Because that's, you know, a lot of what you end up doing.
Which I guess is that duality of both the art of the photography and the science of the compositing that you allude to in the name of the book. And it must be, just in finishing up, personally pretty satisfying to you that a product that's discontinued, that really hasn't been had anything much done to it for ages, is still the backbone of almost every major feature film that's done worldwide, if not then a contributor to it.
Yeah, no, you know, I'm not sure if it's satisfying or frustrating, because in some ways it's like, you know, why isn't it still out there? But yeah, you know, everything has its time. Every cycle kind of comes around, and yeah, I do think you'll continue to see Shake used for years and years in most of these facilities, because, you know, why change? And it's it does the basic stuff that it needs to do, and then until the operating systems move so far along that it just doesn't work on them, I don't see anything. You know, any reason to replace it a lot of times. You know, there's a lot of very old code at a lot of these facilities just because it does what it needs to do, and it's fine. You know, why redo it? But yeah, it was definitely fun to, you know, and satisfying to see that the tools that we decided, that we really made for ourselves, at least it proved we weren't, you know, thinking strangely, because it ended up being used by a lot of people as well.
Well, now, Ron, if somebody wants to follow up on your kind of dialogue and thinking, is digitalcompositing.com the best place for them to go? Or
Yeah. It's, you know, the best thing to do is go to digitalcompositing.com, and we've just put up some forums that you guys are kind enough to host there, that sort of on a per-chapter basis. There's not a whole lot of traction, so I really encourage people to go out there and start seeding some articles and some questions, and I'll be lurking around there and answering stuff too, but it's sort of broken down on a per chapter basis. So, as people, you know, get the new copy of the book and go through it, I would strongly encourage you to go out and put some stuff up on the forums, and let's get some discussion going about what's in there. Even if there's something in there you don't agree with, you know, feel free to toss something up there and let's talk about that too. And I assume that, you know, as we do some of the class over the rest of the year too, that we'll, you know, get into more of the specifics and can use that as a place for people to chat about things.
Sure, and that course is obviously at fxphd.com. Ron, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. It's always a great pleasure. I do enjoy our chats, and it's not much like hard work for me to sit and spend an hour discussing compositing. So thank you so much.
I totally agree. Great fun. Good to talk to you.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. I actually really enjoy listening to that podcast. I always listen to them first before doing the intro, so I know what's going on. And I listen to it on what I consider the most beautiful drive in the country, from Durango, Colorado, over to Grand Junction, through some amazingly beautiful mountain passes with fall colors and fresh snow up on the peaks. I mean, absolutely outstanding, and it was just made even better to actually listen to that podcast. That's, I guess that's how much of a geek I am. But I really enjoyed that conversation, hearing what Ron's been up to, and kind of his thoughts on kind of where the industry's going and what he finds interesting in it. As I mentioned before, we've been working on the new term rollout over at FXPhD. Just announced a new RealFlow course last week that we weren't able to announce in the initial announcement. It's going to be fantastic. We've got a ton of great new courses. You guys know where to find it, fxphd.com. But I got to say, I think it's, and I'm biased, I know, but I think it's going to be our best term yet. As always, we appreciate you taking the time to download the podcast and come to FX Guide and check out the stories. We love hearing from you guys. Drop us a line at podcast@fxguide.com. It's an email address that goes to Mike, Jeff, and I. Again, we just appreciate hearing from you guys. As always, for my partners Mike Seymour and Jeff Huser, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.